From Whiplash to La La Land, writer-director Damien Chazelle and award-winning choreographer Mandy Moore, it's all about one of this award season's most celebrated movies, the magical musical La La Land, here on Pop Culture Confidential.
Actress.
Yeah.
You could write your own role, something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna have my own club. We're gonna play whatever we want.
Is that gonna happen every time?
I think so.
This is the dream. It's conflict and it's compromise. It's very, very exciting.
Welcome to Pop Culture Confidential. I'm Christina Yerling-Biro. When I say La La Land is one of the most buzzed about movies this award season, I'm not kidding. It literally won every award it was nominated for at this year's Golden Globes, including for the movie, the director, and the stars. It is now the most awarded film in Golden Globe history, and its road to Oscar glory seems unstoppable. You may have noticed that all the La La Land winners thanked Mandy Moore. No, not the actress, but the award-winning choreographer. I'm thrilled to get to talk to Mandy Moore later on the show. She's choreographed for movies like Silver Linings Playbook and TV's Dancing with the Stars. We talk about her amazing musical numbers in La La Land, shutting down major LA freeways, and teaching actors Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling to dance, rivaling the greats like Fred and Ginger. But first...
City of stars, are you shining just for me?
Director Damien Chazelle was only in his late 20s when he burst on the scene with his movie Whiplash. The movie, about an abusive jazz band conductor, was actually partly based on Chazelle's own experiences as a drummer in his high school band back in New Jersey. Whiplash was something of a sensation, and he's now defying all expectations with his next passion project, La La Land. La La Land is Damien Chazelle's ode to Hollywood and to musicals like Singing in the Rain, Top Hat, and Jacques Demy's The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and to the city of Los Angeles itself, the freeways, sound stages, and the dreamers and the heartbreak. It stars Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, whose on-screen chemistry we've seen before in several other movies that they've done together. They play Mia, an aspiring actress, and jazz pianist Sebastian, who dreams of owning his own club. La La Land is about their blooming romance, a love story in the City of Angels, but also the harsh realities of Hollywood, the endless auditions, and the disappointment. The actors went all in. Emma Stone, who sung on Broadway and cabaret, learned to tap and all manner of dance. And Gosling studied jazz piano and plays the piano himself in the movie.
It's pretty strange that we keep running into each other.
Maybe it means something.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so.
How are you going to be a revolutionary if you're such a traditionalist? You're holding on to the past, but jazz is about the future.
Yes, you are.
Maybe I'm not. It's like a pipe dream.
La La Land is shot beautifully in 35mm by Swedish cinematographer Linus Sandgren, and it's Chazelle's six-year passion project that he embarked on with his best friend from college, the composer Justin Hurwitz. The movie seems to have been on their minds since their college years when they made a successful short film, a black-and-white musical named Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. And there seems to be some reoccurring themes in Damien Chazelle's movies. Competition versus compassion. What does it take to make it in Hollywood, in the arts? And of course, the dreamers. In La La Land, he very beautifully shows the big contradictions in Hollywood, the actors slash waiters that come there to try to make it, and of course, the rejection and disappointment. Damien Chazelle was one of those dreamers when he went out to LA as a young man from New Jersey. So I started by asking him, what does it take to make it in Hollywood, to deal with that heartbreak? Who stays and who goes back to Jersey?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I definitely had my moments where I, which maybe everyone does at some point, where I thought, I guess maybe L.A. is just not for me. Maybe I'm just not cut out for L.A.
And what had happened in those moments?
Just the kind of daily ups and downs and daily rejections. I mean, most of your time in LA is spent getting rejected. You're trying to make it into film. And so it becomes a question of how many rejections can you take? And sometimes, you know, I would feel like I was pouring my heart and soul into a script or something that I just felt like was the best possible thing I could ever do. And then to have that just not get any traction or just get kind of rejected flat out would be very hard. And you have to sort of take a moment and sulk a bit and then pick yourself back up. But there is this sort of toughness to LA that I wanted to reflect in the movie. I mean, it's a give and take. You know, the city sort of lures you and has this kind of seductive, romantic kind of sheen that makes you feel sometimes like you're within, you know, grabbing distance of your dream. But then it has a way of very kind of casually tossing you aside or casually crushing you or disappointing you. And yeah, a lot of people, you know, wind up not really wanting to deal with that. I mean, it winds up being a kind of adjustment curve with the city where, you know, anyone who moves here kind of has to adapt to a certain extent. And that was certainly a process I had to go through. And it took years.
I can see both in Whiplash and in La La Land, I get this feeling that you have themes of like compassion versus competitiveness, that maybe you can't have both to succeed. Have you thought about that a lot in your own career?
Yeah, I mean, I guess both movies really were looking at that question of how you balance, you know, life and art and how you balance the, you know, life and career. And just the, you know, that sort of idea of the kind of somewhat, you know, monomaniacal pursuit of a goal, you know, pursuit of a dream in the face of such overwhelming, you know, obstacles, such overwhelmingly negative odds. You know, if the odds are that stacked against you, you have to sort of respond, I guess, by sort of going all in. But then what does that do to the life around you? What does that do to your own ability to kind of be a functioning human being, paying the bills and whatnot, your own ability to have a relationship, your own ability to relate to people around you.
But can you? I mean, you're a decade younger than me, but tell me you can have true love and ambition.
Yes, of course you can. But I think it's more interesting to look at, you know, at the level of drama, more interesting to look at situations where it's difficult to find that equilibrium.
You have Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, who've done several movies together. Of course, old Hollywood is full of legendary pairings, Hepburn Tracy, Fred and Ginger. Did you cast them as a pair?
No, not initially. I mean, what kind of wound up happening was, when I first started writing the movie in like late 2010, early 2011, I had thought of both of them, but it seems like kind of impossible pipe dreams that... that would never, it just seemed like that would never happen. And then basically, more or less 5 or 6 years kind of passed, you know, in which we were trying to raise the financing for the movie and various other casting permutations kind of came and went. And then it was sort of by chance, you know, I happened to meet Ryan while I was doing sort of the Whiplash kind of tour. And then at a certain point also, I needed to find someone to play Mia, and Emma Stone was doing a cabaret on Broadway. So I wound up kind of reaching out to her directly and pitching her the movie. And she was interested. And so she and I started kind of talking about the movie over the course of a few months. And during that time, I had, you know, a couple other meetings with Ryan and kind of started to learn about his interest in old Gene Kelly movies and doing a movie like that. And so I think suddenly this prospect that had seemed at first like very, like kind of an unrealistic pipe dream suddenly seems like it might actually happen. And I think they started talking to each other as well about like, have you heard about this movie? Would you be interested in maybe doing this together? And at around the same time that I became, you know, kind of, realized that might be a realistic proposition as well. And then it all came together very quickly. You know, it was like several months of kind of, you know, just sort of teasing around things and talking. And then they sort of signed on actually within a day of each other.
I got a call back.
What? Come on. For what?
For a TV show. The one that I was telling you about earlier.
The Dangerous Minds meets the OC?
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's
really
incredible.
Exciting. I feel like I said negative stuff about it before.
What?
It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of.
I got the bullets.
Yes.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Oh, my. You know it's playing at the Rialto.
Really?
Yes. You should go. I mean, I can take you.
Okay.
You know, for research.
For research?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Monday night, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
For research.
I'd like to ask you about one of the songs that she sings, the one called Audition, which just made me cry, like I don't know what, which is about what we were talking about before, the dreamers and what you need. You need to be a bit crazy to get in. Tell me a little bit about that, filming that scene. I understand that she sung live. Why?
Well, it was really to just kind of, you know, that scene had to be a moment where everything else kind of got stripped away. And after all the bells and whistles of earlier musical numbers, where it just became about just about her and her character. And so it seemed in keeping with the sort of total naturalism that we needed to approach that scene with to do it live. And it was something that actually Emma initially proposed even before I did, though it had been something I'd been thinking of with Justin, my composer. But yeah, we wound up doing it, you know, live, one single take with Justin playing an electric piano off in another room into Emma's ear, you know, into a little earpiece, so that, you know, basically it could be like a traditional. In a way, we approached it as a traditional kind of vocalist, pianist, accompanist kind of setup, where Emma was free to kind of slide from dialogue into singing at the tempo that she wanted, and free to kind of set the tempo throughout the song and set the emotional tone and really act it.
Did you know what an incredible singer she was, and Ryan also is a piano player, when you got started?
Well, no, I mean, I knew they both had it in them to you know, pull out these characters. But Ryan, you know, really didn't play much piano at all before the movie. I knew his work ethic and his perfectionism, and he just hunkered down and started training. You know, started basically taking piano lessons every day of the week for about 4 months leading up to the shoot, and then even during shooting, he'd be practicing in it, you know, on a little piano in his trailer. You know, between you know, during break and stuff. So that was really an instance of Ryan just kind of rising to a challenge, you know, and actually kind of blowing us all away, because we had planned to have piano double and to kind of do a little bit of editing around his pieces. But as it turns out in the movie, yeah, we never used it. And with Emma, you know, again, I'd seen her on Broadway, and so I knew that she could deliver as well. But both of them, you know, did, in addition to Ryan's piano playing, you know, both Emma and Ryan did about 3 months of kind of on-site dancing, singing, training, you know, rehearsals. You know, we just really, it was, I mean, I think it was the only thing that made the movie possible, really, was that both actors were so willing and eager to do the work, to actually, you know, not half-ass it, and to really rehearse the way you need to.
My aunt used to live in Paris. I remember she used to come home and she would tell us stories about being abroad, and I remember she told us that she jumped into the river once, barefoot. She smiled, left without looking, and tumbled into the sand. The water was freezing. She spent a month sneezing, but said she would do it again. Here's to the ones who dream, foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
You've worked with our Swedish DP, Linus Sandgren. What were some of the references and the visions that you imparted to him that you wanted to have in La La Land?
Well, I mean, that was... It's it was really one of the greatest experiences I've ever had working with Lena. And I think right at the outset, we were talking about, you know, just any movies that kind of seem to point the way towards how to invest real life with magic, you know, and how to take real locations and real situations and a somewhat naturalistic approach to photography, mm-hmm. but give it this kind of extra, you know, magical realist dimension in terms of color palette, in terms of camera movement, in terms of texture. So we, you know, it's part of why we were very adamant about shooting on film, shooting anamorphic, you know, and shooting, you know, eventually kind of decided to shoot a lot of the, you know, most of the nightscapes at either magic hour or twilight, to get those sort of blues and purples in the sky.
And that must have been a trip to catch the magic that those hours that you were.
Yeah, it was. it made logistics, you know, very tricky. But we just planned everything very kind of, you know, very minutely, and would just kind of, you know, go through in very, very minute detail, you know, storyboards, shot lists, shot diagrams, just trying to kind of build each image of the movie way in advance so that we kind of knew exactly what we were doing. And then looking at lots of references, looking at a lot of paintings and a lot of photography. But in terms of films, I mean, I think for the most part, you know, certainly the films of Jacques Demy, mm-hmm. The sort of use of color, the old Technicolor films of the, you know, 50s and 60s, especially the Technicolor musicals, Vincent Minnelli movies like Singing in the Rain, Vincent Minnelli movies like The Bandwagon and Meet Me in St. Louis,
right.
Stanley Donen movies like Singing in the Rain, and just kind of seeing just how the lushness of those color palettes were achieved. And then also just kind of looking at more recent, you know, recent examples, especially examples of Los Angeles on film, movies like, you know, like The Long Goodbye and, you know, Boogie Nights and, you know, Pulp Fiction and, yeah, just kind of trying to kind of see how you make L.A. a character in its own right.
So you're going to be at the Oscars. You're likely to win some big awards. Will you be thinking about those dreamers / actors / waiters? And what do you think that you'll be telling them?
Well, I'm trying not to think ahead to that too much. But I've already been and will continue to, you know, think of all those, as you say, all those dreamers of which, you know, which I count myself one of them. I mean, we all kind of were with this movie. And there was something, I mean, I guess in a weird way, the message that I wanted to impart in the movie is sort of the message of how the movie got made too, which is just, you know, just not giving up on the dreams, no matter how unrealistic it seems, and no matter how much evidence the universe seems to provide you that it's not, that it's just not going to happen. I think, you know, that's just, that in a weird way was the lesson I think we all took from making the movie. And I think it's in some way the lesson of the movie, you know, just to hold on and to not give up.
Last question, what is your next project?
Oh, well, not entirely sure, but theoretically, I'm hoping to do, I've been working on this movie about Neil Armstrong and the moon landing with Ryan playing Neil. So hopefully that'll be shooting, we're sort of getting that ready to shoot. So hopefully that'll be shooting kind of later next year.
Well, you can't get more of a dreamer that accomplished something there, right?
Yes, exactly. So very true.
But thank you so much, Mr. Shill, and best of luck with all the awards, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much to Damien Chazelle. Good luck at the Oscars. The best way to describe my next guest's work on La La Land is simply spectacular. Not only has award-winning choreographer Mandy Moore taught non-dancers Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling to dance, she also choreographed some of the most elaborate scenes in modern musical history. Like 30 dancers, 100 extras, and at least 60 cars in the scorching LA heat in the incredible opening number Another Day of Sun on the LA freeway. We are in an era where dance, videos, and dance competitions on TV are huge, and Mandy Moore seems to command every single style of dance throughout her vast career. In addition to La La Land, she's worked on movies like Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, and Joy, and TV reality shows like So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars. Miss Mandy Moore, thank you so much for being here and congratulations on the success of the movie.
Thank you so much. It is pretty exciting.
I talked to Mr. Chazelle earlier about Dreamers, which I think the movie is so incredibly in showing, and coming out to LA and all the, you know, heartbreak and all the loveliness about and how difficult it is, isn't it? And for an actor, but for a dancer, it must really be the same way. I understand you came to LA with $500 and a I read, but what does it take to make it or to head home to Colorado? What do you need to have as a dancer?
You know, I think for me, I so understood Emma's character, Mia, you know, that scene towards the end of the film where she's crying, you know, he's come up and said to her, you know, you have a big audition. And she was just like, you know what, maybe I'm just not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe this is a pipe dream. You know, I don't know the amount of times I've had that conversation with my parents, you know, or my friends. And, you know, I think so many artists and so many people that pursue something that is seems to be such a dream, you know, something that seems so far away, you know, I think it takes an incredible sense of resilience. And, you know, I think just having a little seed inside always to like really love it, you know. And I have to credit my dance teachers growing up. You know, if I didn't love dance as much as I do, I think I probably would have moved home after the first year, you know. But I knew for me, yeah, I mean, I've never felt so alive. I've never felt so real. I've never felt so, you know, fill in the blank of anything that feels great as I do when I dance and I create, you know. And I feel very lucky to have found that in my life. And, you know, believe me, I had my fair share of, you know, those same kind of auditions that Emma was doing, you know, like, except for you're dancing, you know, in front of Madonna, or you're dancing in front of whoever and they're eating a sandwich and they could care less, you know, and you're dancing your heart out. So yeah, I think we all have those stories, but I think it's the people that, you know, really have a rooted sense of loving the craft. And also a sense of like, I'm not going to take no for an answer because I know this is what I'm supposed to be doing in my life. You know, I think those are the people that end up making it.
It's the true sense of themselves, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and a little bit of luck along the way, for sure. I mean, you got to get some experiences and some things along the way. But yeah, an ultimate bit of love for sure.
In every era, dance has been one of the pillars of pop culture. I grew up in the 80s with Michael Jackson and so on. But I have a reflection. As a professional dancer at your level, a choreographer, it seems that it has grown even more, that today you have to know every single style imaginable to be able to work on the huge shows that you work on TV, for example. Is this true?
Oh, yeah, 100%. You know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I grew up on all of those films and videos, you know, the start of MTV. And that's what inspired me to move to Los Angeles to become a professional dancer. And at that time, you know, it was jazz type dancing that I was looking for, commercial jazz. That's what I was mostly trained in. But then as I got out here and as, you know, there was a little time period there for about 10 years where there was not a lot of dance happening, you know, very little was happening as far as any dance in film or television. And then about 10, 12 years ago, it started to make another, you know, it started to surge again. So luckily, as it came back, people had been, I think, in hibernation for 10 years and had been, you know, just training and trying all different styles of dance. And, you know, the nice thing is right now in dance, it's true. Like, you have to be able to have a knowledge of so many different kinds of styles and cultures and types of music. You know, it's not just one note anymore at all.
No, because when I was like researching you and looking into things, it's everything. It's musicals, but it's salsa, it's merengue, it's this. And I mean, you've done everything imaginable, which seems to be just, you have to have that to get to your level, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, lucky enough, growing up in a small town in Colorado, somehow we at the studio were exposed to a lot of different kinds of dance very early. Like, I remember my first couple years of dancing, you know, taking a belly dancing class or a folkloric class, or I actually started dancing break dancing. So, you know, I was taking break dancing and ballet and tap. And so being exposed to all the different kinds of styles at a really early age, I think that I grew to appreciate all different styles of dance, you know, and I wasn't just trained in one style completely. You know, I understood that there were other kinds of dance out there, and I really, you know, had a yearning to learn about those and you know, put myself in a lot of classes and tried to learn a lot of different styles.
What are the styles that you incorporated and worked with in La La Land?
Mostly the vocabulary sat in tap and ballroom, specifically foxtrot and waltzing. Mm-hmm. And then there was obviously a little bit of jazz style, old Hollywood, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, and then even up into like Jerome Robbins and a bit of Fosse in there. You know, I definitely would say some of it sat in kind of Jack Cole style jazz. But mostly it was tap and waltzing and foxtrot.
And did you do visual research? I mean, did you look at tons of movies and things like that before you got started?
Yeah, the nice thing is when I read the script, it was so visual. It's even on the page, it was very visual. And my very first meeting with Damien after I got the job, we sat down and, you know, he would send me YouTube links and I would send him things back. And we would just have all these conversations about the tone and the style and the feel that he wanted from the dance. Because, you know, I think that people can think dance is all different things, you know, and I really wanted to make sure that I understood what Damien's vision was for it and what he wanted. We had a lot of conversations about how the dance would just happen, mm-hmm. that it would be two people and they would just fall into the dance, or even in that opening scene that there's never a moment where everyone just like stops down and is dancing and doing their best moves, you know, that it has this beautiful evolution. And before you know it, at the end, you have everyone unison dancing on the cars and in between the cars. But it was never a moment that can happen a lot in dance where everyone just like stops and does like a really cool breakdown. Right. You know, he wanted to make sure that all of that just felt very fluid. And, you know, we would watch I'm sure many of the great scenes that you would agree with, you know, anything from Gene Kelly, basically. we watched the opening scene of Guys and Dolls, an American in Paris ballet, Swing Time, Top Hat, specifically Cheek to Cheek, a Lovely Day to be Caught in the Rain, you know, all these really iconic, incredible dance scenes. And we would just break them down and talk about them and say what we liked about them and how we could reference and be inspired by that work for our film.
Do you mind breaking down a little bit that incredible opening scene? How much time did you have to prep for that and how many people were involved?
Yeah, it was an amazing process, actually.
Just to shut down the freeway must have been a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, when you write that in a script and you're like, okay, we're going to shut down the freeway and it's going to be the most epic dance number ever. And good luck. It's opening the opening scene, you know. There was a bit of panic that went into all of it. But, you know, I did have the luxury of having, I was brought on very early into the process. So I had a really nice pre-production phase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the steps went, you know, Damien and I met, he and I would listen to the music. We would actually draw out cards on a piece of paper and in, you know, in a traffic jam, and he would draw with an arrow where he felt the camera should go. And then we would talk about, okay, that's where the camera goes. Now, what is the camera seeing? You know, seeing one girl get out of a car and then she's joined by another two and then another two. And then all of a sudden it whips to another group and four of them get out. And then someone flips off a car, you know, so the kind of like the road markers, I guess I would say, were in place very early with Damien, because he was also very specific about what he wanted to see. Mm-hmm. So then once I knew what that was, I went along the path of actually trying to create it, which I was able to get a skeleton crew of about 10 dancers, and we would park our cars out in the parking lot outside the dance studio.
Your own cars.
And yes, our own cars at first for the skeleton crew. And we would just play, you know, and obviously we weren't going to get up on our own cars, because I don't know if you do this, but if you stand on the roof of your car, you will definitely ruin it.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Don't try it. It actually will ruin the top of your car. But then after I kind of created, I guess I would call it phrases of movement, you know, say that it was a dancer who was moving down the middle of the cars, they would have a certain phrase of movement. If someone was moving across the cars, they would have a certain phrase. If they were staying on the cars, they had a different phrase, and all of it complemented, or it was complementary. So once I got that, then the transportation director, Gino Hart, was able to get me kind of a, just like a beater car. And then that was really great because I got to actually get up on the car, you know, stomp on the car, flip on the car, do whatever we needed to. And that really informed so much of what we weren't able to figure out, you know, in that initial creative process with the skeleton crew. And then, yeah, once that happened, then came the casting process, which was very specific. Again, Damien had a very specific idea of how or who he wanted these people to be, what they, he wanted them to look like, you know, dance like. So, you know, I was able to hire 30 dancers that were absolutely incredible, some of the best in Los Angeles. And along with 100 extras, we put together that scene on the freeway, and we shut down the freeway for 2 days. And we actually had to go, funny enough, I had to go to a California Department of Transportation meeting and kind of pitch our idea, because we were basically begging for another day of rehearsal, because we knew to get up there and shoot that massive scene in 2 days was going to be pushing it. So we had wanted maybe another day, like before that time. And they basically were like, no, we're not shutting down the freeway for a day, but we'll give you 12 hours. So the weekend before, we were able to get the freeway from midnight to noon. And the dancers, you know, were called at 3:30 a.m. We got all the cars up there. We got the camera up there. We just went through shot by shot what we were wanting. And it was a very informative rehearsal, I will say that, you know, because, of course, there's that panic of like, oh, God, I thought that was going to work and it didn't, you know, with the camera or, you know, with the steps or, you know, it's obviously a lot of things to come together. But if we hadn't had that 12-hour rehearsal, you know, I'm not sure that number would have turned out the way it did. So we were very, very lucky and very thankful to the Department of Transportation for giving that to us.
I'd like to get into ask you a little bit about working with non-professional dancers. I'm, of course, thinking of Emma and Ryan, who are excellent, but I'm supposing that they weren't dancers before. How do you start with two non-professional dancers? What's the first day like?
The first day was separate for both of them, and I purposely kept them separate for a long time because I felt that I knew I've had a lot of experience teaching. You know, I teach children, I teach adults dance. And so luckily I, you know, kind of had that in my back pocket, and I understand what it takes to get somebody from point A to point B when it comes to dance. And I knew with Ryan and Emma, especially, I wanted to get to know them each individually and get to understand how they learned and what, you know, what their strengths and their weaknesses were. And I knew that if I, you know, just put them together, crashed them together in that first rehearsal, we'd never get anything done because it'd be kind of like the blind leading the blind, I guess, you know? And so they trained separately for about 6 weeks before I ever put them together. And, you know, those initial kind of private coaching sessions were of stretching, obviously, coordination exercises. I worked a lot on how to pick up patterns and movements, how to hear rhythm in movements, how to retain choreography, because that's the thing too, I think, for non-dancers is, you know, Ryan would always say, like, how am I supposed to remember this tomorrow? You know, and I would talk to him about how a lot of it is repetition, right? Like, you just have to, I have a way of giving the step to him that will create a repetitive pattern, which we will then be able to repeat and learn. So, you know, and above all, really, my big thing is I wanted to make sure that they loved dance and they really loved to learn dance, because I knew they would be way outside their comfort zones. And, you know, the worst thing that a dancer can do is not be vulnerable or open. You know, so I wanted to make sure that they felt very comfortable, very confident, and that they really loved it, because then when we would do those one takes, I mean, their duet take, I think, was 7 minutes, 6.5 minutes. And, you know, it was in one take, yeah, an act magic hour, you know, and the amount of pressure that was on them. I thought, you know, if I could just plant a little seed of them really loving it and enjoying it, that would get us much further than me just like teaching them dance steps, you know, and rehearsing them and screaming at them. So, you know, luckily I never had to scream at them.
That's the one called Lovely Night, right? It's just amazing.
Yeah.
The sun is nearly gone. The lights are turning on. A silver shine that
stretches to the sea. We stumbled on a view that's tailor-made for two. What a shame those two are, you and me. Some other girl and guy would love this swirling sky, but there's only you and I, and we've got no shot. This could never be. You're not the type for me, and there's not a spark inside. What a waste of a lovely night.
And that's a very MGM style type of dance, I guess, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
What is a characteristic of an MGM style? What were moves, if I'm not being stupid in asking that question, what moves represent?
Well, you know, for me, I think that style is an emotion or a feeling. You know, I think that the MGM style dance had a beautiful storyline. You know, they always had a bit of motif, you know, like there would be a certain step that might be repeated a couple times. There was always for me, MGM style movement and musicals always had a beginning, middle, and end to the dance. You know, it was, again, very rarely did they ever just stop down and everybody dance. You know, it was, they seemed to continue to push the story forward, like any great musical does, through the dance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was always a really nice build and a lot of, I mean, I don't know, I could be biased, but I always just felt like that style also had a lot of creativity and unique characteristics to the movement. You know, it wasn't just normal steps that you'd see. Yeah, I guess that's kind of how I would explain it.
Do you have a favorite one if one of the listeners wants to go and see what you were just explaining?
Well, I mean, I think for A Lovely Night, we really referenced a Lovely Day to Be Caught in the Rain from Fred and Ginger. I mean, it's an incredible piece of work, and the storytelling and the build in that number. I mean, their steps, of course, are incredible, but just their chemistry. You know, Damien and I were so taken by that scene and really wanted to inspire Ryan and Emma, you know, to just find some of those qualities, which I really feel like we were successful at. For sure.
Thank you so much for your time, Miss Moore, and for this movie, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to choreographer Mandy Moore and writer-director Damien Chazelle. La La Land is out in the U.S. now and premieres in Sweden on January 27th. And thank you so much for listening to Pop Culture Confidential. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and follow us on popcultureconfidential.com and our Twitter at @podpopculture. This show was edited by Tom Hansen, intro music by Carl Borg, and produced by Renee Witterstedt and myself. I'm Christina Jörling Biro. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.